Welcome to the Commerce Talks podcast, episode number 52. Today, my guest is Philip Jackson. He is chief commerce officer at Rightpoint, and he is building a very exciting startup called Future Commerce with very interesting content around the commerce industry and a very cool podcast, by the way. He is part of the e-commerce circus now for over 20 years. He was and is a developer. He was covering the whole Magento development from the inside. He has very popular videos on the Magento technologies on YouTube. That's what we are also talking about in the podcast. And today we are trying to recap and digest the Magento time. We try to understand if the same thing is happening now with Shopify, how the market has changed, how B2B has changed, what the difference is between the European ecosystem and the US ecosystem. So for all the people in the commerce industry, vendor-wise or technology partner-wise, that's definitely a must hear. So enjoy episode number 52. Philip, welcome to the Commerce Talks show, episode number 50-something, I think. It is yours, an experienced podcast host. I guess you also sometimes forget which episode number you're recording. Today, we are talking about commerce, as it is actually the main topic in Commerce Talks. But with your background and experience, I think that's going to be a very entertaining episode. Please tell our audience who you are and who you're working for.
Yeah, thanks. And so good to be here, Alexander. Wait, so, it's going to be a long story. The wind up is really just sort of which part of the story is applicable to this audience. So by day, my mild mannered, Clark Kent personality to my Superman, would be that I am the chief commerce officer at a consulting strategy firm called Rightpoint. Based out of Chicago. I come to Rightpoint via acquisition. I spent 8 years going on 9 at a company called Something Digital, which was a Magento and Shopify agency, where I ran our strategy ops practice lead, and then and into the executive team. And I have a background of 12 some years in the Magento ecosystem. Before that, as a developer. And before that, I used to lead dev teams to build custom e-commerce platforms from scratch. And that was sort of where I started my career, from the early 2000s into about, 2008, when I discovered that, a well-known monolithic e-commerce platform that we all, know and love, with various degrees of love. And then by night, I have a startup. I founded a media business a few years ago with my co-founder, Brian Lang. One of the things that we started in that media business was a podcast called Future Commerce. And Future Commerce has taken off. We have about 25,000 folks who pay attention to our content and across the ecosystem. And, you know, we don't just talk about one flavor of e-commerce. You know, we talk about how digital is changing everything in retail, B2B, and beyond. And we think that there's a real need for a modern trade publication, because a lot of the retail trade publications are pretty stodgy and old and crufty. And we have a voice, and we use great design to communicate some really original ideas and thoughts. And and we put out content 5 days a week across a couple podcasts and a bunch of newsletters and essays, and a bunch of reports too, with the custom research component that we developed over the last couple of years. So that's who I am.
Okay, then let's maybe compare notes on our common history in e-commerce. Did you know that Magento was the reason why Spryker was founded?
I do. Yeah. I do know exactly. Yeah. I do. I take it, you know, we like to say, this ecosystem, especially around open source and e-commerce, probably wouldn't have existed without the complexity, or the history of Magento, but it has also, created a reason for so many other things to exist in the world to try to solve problems differently. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Magento was like a great influencer for the whole ecosystem. So my first touchpoint with Magento was when I joined the Otto Group in 2005, and Otto was then running on Intershop.
on a very, very complex Intershop setup with already hundreds of millions of revenue. And then in the new media department, which was in mail order companies and brick and mortar companies, you know, all these e-commerce people were called like new media. We had some experiments playing around with Magento. And with Magento, I think that was like the first kind of very almost enterprise ready e-commerce solution, which you just could extract on a PHP server. So it was super easy to get a first demo shop running. And then we showed this to our tech guys in the auto basement and say, okay, why can't we do this with our Intershop installation then? And I think that's how it all started, you know. And then only like 2 years later, Zalando started based on a Magento version first, and then they migrated to a Java version. But it showed that it was a huge starting point for a lot of companies. And actually, that was also the time when Magento and the Magento community was very active in the Barcamp community, which was between 2008 and 2012, a big thing in the German market. And I think it was also big now it kind of died, but it was big then. And you have been around in this ecosystem the whole way. When Boris and I compare notes on Magento and look back, and obviously we draw some learnings from Magento time, it is there was a lot of hate and shitstorm about Magento from people that didn't understand the system correctly, that expected kind of WordPress easy plug and play functionality out of a commerce system Magento was never designed for, and therefore created opportunities for other vendors. So when you're looking to the whole Magento development from a US perspective, were there some important points along the way, milestones where we'd say, okay, here it really made an impact. This year was really interesting. If ABC would have happened in 2009, if, I don't know, Walmart would have started its e-commerce enterprise on Magento, everything would have turned out different.
So I play this game a lot. I think about this a lot. What if something had happened? And I think there are... I have this concept that I've written quite a bit about over at Future Commerce, called sacrificial lambs. And, you've seen this in the world in many forms. The, businesses who never really, live long enough to inherit the world that they created. There's a great example. Napster is probably the greatest example of creating a consumer expectation around digital delivery of music. But their business model didn't lend them to, capitalize on the expectation that they created in the marketplace. Who capitalized on it? Well, if you look a little forward in time from, you know, that timeline from 2000, 2001, it was very soon after that Apple acquired a license for Amazon's OneClick that made the iTunes store viable, and buying digital music, and having an ecosystem around it, was for many people the very first purchase they ever made online. Like, one click music purchases from Apple was an entrance to e-commerce as we know it. Napster exists today in theory. It still has a website, like it has a brand, but no reasonable person is using Napster. For me, and I'll get myself in trouble saying this because we still deliver Magento at scale for enterprise, and it is not the same platform today that it was 12 years ago. I think it is still very viable in certain deployments, and there will always be a market for deployed software, especially in highly regulated industries and very complex industries, and specifically around open source. So I'm just making sure I cover all my bases and not get myself in trouble. But if Magento had come out in 2010 and not 2008, if Magento had come out in 2010 or 11, a lot of the architecture decisions that made Magento a difficult and frustrating platform to work with and created a very, very steep learning curve would have been rethought. A good example would be EAV architecture. Would not have been an architecture that would have been adopted and then had to have been proliferated for over a decade in the core of the platform, because document storage databases became much more prevalent in the following years. You would probably also not have built it on a pure LAMP stack with the idea that the world runs on LAMP. You might have adopted Ruby. You would have had a larger, more fanatic community around, you know, a Cassandra or a Mongo based part of the catalog instead of being pure LAMP and solving everything in a LAMP environment. And I think part of the architecture decisions are the things that long term have created hurdles to adoption, because the world has just not been long for and by the way, Magento has had incredible commercial success. I mean, they had a multiple exits over time, over and over again. So some, you know, a lot of commercial success around the software itself and the community that came around it. So in no way am I saying, could it have been Shopify scale though? Well, Shopify basically is the Magento story, just happening further down the timeline. And it also happened pre-cloud, right? So cloud, I was developing Magento on the cloud. One of my very first cloud deployments ever was a Magento deployment on AWS circa late 2009 or early 2010. This is before, you know, there were web consoles for EC2. It was all API only on the command line. So this is, you know, these things have been around for a while. They were contemporaneous, but they would have been, it happened on the cusp of a fundamental change in the way that we write software, the way that we deploy software, and the way that the world consumes software. If it had happened 2-3 years later, I think Magento would be the dominant player in the marketplace and would have solved a lot of the things that were challenging. Also, so I've only talked about back-end architecture and infrastructure. The front-end stack is a nightmare for new developers. And one of the major challenges, and they had a fork in the road that I was a part of a steering committee with eBay and then Magento on its own under Primera Partners, which was a private equity firm that had acquired it away from eBay Enterprise somewhere out of 2012 or 13. Part of that conversation was, if we're going to, how are we going to deliver a front-end developer DevRel experience that makes it a joy to work in? And there was this fundamental argument of, do we use an open source stack that is common, like Bootstrap, that everybody can buy into? Do we use, or do we create something of our own that is potentially has its own paradigm that is specific to commerce? And, you know, the powers that be saw a lot more, looking back now, and I'm giving an oral history of something that I did not, you know, that I am narrating someone else's history, but I think it's pretty clear that they chose to create the software of their own accord in a front-end stack of their own, seeing that it would be more valuable as a product to sell later on in a private equity model for an acquirer to say that we have something that we created that is intellectual property that is common only to Magento itself and creates an artificial barrier to have certifications around and for them to own the entire developer experience of saying that this is like a piece of commercial software that you can certify people in. So long story short, a lot of decisions were made over time and during certain eras that I think just were too early. And had they been done later, we would have rethought the way that we're tackling certain challenges. And then lastly, you know, because I have the definitive video on explaining what EAV is in the marketplace on YouTube, it has all of, I don't know, probably 2,000 views because nobody cares. But it is often cited as like the definitive explanation of how to think about
it. I will put a link in the show notes.
Please, yeah. It's a very boring 30-minute watch. But one of the things around entity attribute value and sort of it as a schema is you can't enforce business rules from a schema level. So that creates another challenge of business complexity. And all of this in service of what? Taking a database offline for a few minutes for you to make a schema update? And it's just a misguided architecture for a challenge that very few people ever have, when your site has to go down anyway in the Magento world for hours at a time for you to do offline index updates. So it's just layers upon layers upon layers of complexity that were brilliant implementations of requirements from brilliant developers that didn't understand the audience that was consuming it. And none of these people were merchants. None of these people actually had to live and consume the software or develop on the software as a platform. And I think that, you know, a few years later, they would have had greater immersion in an emergent ecosystem of e-commerce and more people to inform them about the way that their software was being created. I have a whole other rant about something else that I'd like to get to, but that is, has been the frustration of being so, of having my career be so closely tied and my success in my career being so closely tied to the success of Magento for many years.
And I think one reason some of the architectural decisions have been made way before 2008, it started kind of an agency solution. Like Yoav and Roy like did customer projects with it, and that actually the most e-commerce software solutions were born that way. It was customer projects, and then we had like 10 similar customer projects, and then you try to do the software out of it. Although I think it started in 2003, 2004. And therefore it's like, it's all, and it's one of the reasons and one of the ways how we explain why we are different. It's like when we started in 2014, 15, the world was very different. So, and we could start it.
And we
had the chance. And I think that was very unique, in the commerce industry for vendors. We could afford to start without the first 20 customers that would, start like an enterprise project with us as a service project, so we could build it on a whiteboard, which was not the case in the Magento environment. But what is where I see similarities between Magento and Shopify, and you have experience like in both worlds, is in 2008, 2009, every commerce problem that was around in B2B, in B2C, one product a day business models, marketplace models, so everything was tried to solve with Magento. And I see the tendency today that because Shopify is so popular, as you said, it's kind of the it's our day's Magento kind of.
It's the dominant.
And now people try to solve everything with Shopify, even complex business model that leads to some frustration. And they are way better in community management, so you have to give Shopify that. But obviously, in some enterprise projects, you see unhappy developers or unhappy project managers. So, would you share this view, or do you think it's kind of different what's happening now?
Maybe I have a more abstracted idea that people and therefore businesses, because businesses aren't people, although we like to in the United States refer to corporations as, you know, as beings. businesses and thrive in boundaries, and they thrive in boundaries because people thrive in boundaries. I believe when boundaries are set, we exercise our brilliance to solve problems even given a boundary. And one arbitrary boundary of many that Shopify laid out in its ecosystem was, where are the points of greatest complexity? Checkout's one of them, right? Checkout is an incredible point of complexity for most merchants. You're solving an identity problem, right? First and foremost, so there's authentication there. You're solving payments, you're solving logistics. All of these things sort of converge there. And it's also the area of greatest investment and highest complexity in any e-commerce platform I have ever worked on, including customer software that I built for, you know, a decade before finding Magento. And checkout is just fundamentally tough to solve for. And every customer, if given the flexibility to be able to do it, will do something to change their checkout. They will. So putting an arbitrary boundary around an area that is incredibly complex to solve it, to not allow brands to make changes to it, has actually been the thing. It's counterintuitive. Has been the thing that's caused the greatest success for Shopify, is to allow businesses to only focus on the things that they can change. And when you give them less choice in the platform, and this is not an argument away from open source, by the way, but it sounds like it is. If you cannot spend your valuable mental energy and development effort on an area in one area and you can only focus it in another area, which is much further up the funnel, maybe you start to actually think about the things that cause you to have to be more fundamentally better at being a business and not being good at being developers. And that's where I think there's been this real dividing line, is that a decade ago, you know, if you wanted to be in e-commerce, you had to be able to solve all of these really tough challenges. You had to run a dev team. You had to understand, you know, Scrum and Agile. You had to understand infrastructure, and you had to, or you had to have, you know, deep pockets to afford partners that can do all of those things for you. That's no longer the case. And I think the world is better for having more merchants focus on the things that they're really good at, which is making great products that the world wants and selling it to them. Now B2B has its own challenges and we can touch on that. But I think really just this arbitrary boundary that was put into place, the other one being limited customization outside of apps. And that created a more democratized marketplace in Shopify for more people to share in the market dynamics and the network effects sharing a distribution of wealth in the value chain of creating an e-commerce experience. But long story short, the more that e-commerce grows, right, Alexander, like we're in an era right now where every single interaction is being influenced by digital. The greater that that grows, the more that we're seeing that this one experience and this one strategy is not fit for everybody, and it never will be. That's like only one e-commerce platform is no more suitable than only one store to shop on ever. There are stores other than Amazon, and I think the world is starting to show that that we want more choice and greater choice of where to shop. We have that in the real world. We have it in digital at a different scale. So long story here is, as e-commerce grows, our need for nuance in solving problems in very specific ways and preferences around stack and deployments and proficiency in solving certain kinds of problems, specifically, you know, not just B2B, which is this big like nebulous thing that, you know, like there's complexity in manufacturing, there's complexity in automotive, there's different types of challenges to solve for. The pie grows bigger for everybody. And that means that the slices of the pie grow bigger over time too. And there's more opportunity now than there has ever been before for challenger platforms to come into the marketplace and to provide vertical industry specific solutions. One being, I see more opportunity right now for verticalized and category specific e-commerce platforms than have ever existed before. Furniture is a really good example of that. There's, I'm aware of at least one SaaS e-commerce platform called Commerce Bear, which just raised a pre-seed round. They are specifically trying to create an e-commerce platform just for furniture. Why? Well, because furniture has its own challenges around logistics and supply chain. It has its own challenges where they don't just sell on Amazon. Like there's vertical marketplaces for consumers just for furniture. Wayfair is one. There's resale for furniture and owning your resale experience. So there's you know, the logistics and shipping of furniture has its own challenges as well. So I think as digital becomes more pervasive, the verticalization of e-commerce will become much more prevalent, and the need for more platforms that solve challenges and solve these problems differently and have more opinions about how you solve those problems will be much greater as well. So I think everybody can win, is what I'm trying to say in a very long-winded way.
Let's hope that it's true. So I'm a little bit careful with the argument. There's more than Amazon, because this argument is used usually by weak retailers. In
probably true.
When we ask them, okay, what's your USP? But yeah, yes, more than Amazon, you can't shop everything on Amazon. So, but I am in your context, right?
Yeah. Amazon is also your frenemy, right? Like it is also probably the greatest opportunity of channel for, you know, long-term customer relationship. And the channel of least resistance for most customers too. So, not knocking or discounting it in any way.
Yeah. So I've recorded, it was not here in the podcast. It was on Spryker On Air, which is another format, we are doing. There was, Bob Burke, The former CEO of ATG. And I discussed with Bob Burke, okay, what kind of, what kind of requirements did you remember from your time as an ATG CEO, and how did those requirements change over time? And I want to hear your view on that. And he said, you know, in 2002, it was a lot of questions like, which was like the before Magento time. Yep. So it was like the early days of SAP Hybris or Hybris back then, and Intershop, and I think IBM WebSphere and ATG were like the dominant solutions back then. And the questions from customers were around, can this solution support a certain number of users at a peak time? Can I use it for personalization, and can it manage and deploy promotions? And instead, a couple of years later, the question changed into what are these SEO capabilities? You know, this kind of Google hype started like 2003, 2004. And is it able to adapt social commerce? And is it able to adapt multiple front ends? I think that was even the time when Wayfair was, I think, what was Wayfair? Was it Hayneedle or CSN Stores before it was Wayfair? Mm-hmm. So, but they run on like, I don't know, 300 different like front ends, you know, www.couch.org and www.furniture4kitchen.net, all this stuff. So do you see, and this was kind of, it was all questions around like online shops. It was like the desktop version was still like the main thing. Do you see them? And as you said, you see potential for vertical solutions or for specific niches of industries. Do you see that these requirements have changed over time? Because you're working, if I understand your job correctly, you're involved pretty early in the decision-making process, right? And customers are telling you, so what are their wishes and requirements?
Yeah, well, that's it can be... That itself is its own podcast. There's two sides of that job, which is a lot, like more than you would believe. A lot of businesses follow path of least resistance around e-commerce platform architecture selection. So part of that, especially in enterprise, it's I already have a solution that went through vendor procurement, and that took me 18 months. So this idea of let me find the best solution is will never happen. The best solution for me is the one that doesn't require me to have to, you know, fight vendor procurement for a year. So they find an e-commerce platform, and they're going to, you know, stamp and repeat it in their organization. And what they're really trying to figure out is what's the most flexible one that'll get me a decade down the road. And that's just the truth. So in that case, like, you know, you see a lot of legacy deployments of a lot of legacy software, and you look at big CPG companies, they have 90, 95 brands in as, you know, big holding company, and they all have their own strategies. They all have their own teams. They're not cross-functional. There's no one person anywhere in the organization, even if their title is innovation officer. Like no one has it sounds very critical, but it's just the truth. No one has a big overarching strategy or a vision of what they're trying to accomplish. Everybody is just trying to, fulfill check some items off of a list of a roadmap of things of, the next 4 years, we're going to do direct to consumer. So that's where we need to be invested. And that's how it actually works. What would be nice is having, is really thinking about where your challenges a few years from now will be. And let's think about how we build a business for that. And I, it's interesting because even if let's look backwards a little bit, and I'll be self-critical, I never would have expected that a common challenge between B2C and B2B a few, going back, you know, let's say now 2015 or 16, I don't think anybody would have been talking about the rising cost of acquisition for a customer and management of e-commerce, because there are so many. I feel like the old guy in these conversations, but
We are becoming the old guys in this conversation.
It's true, actually. You're right. We are. 10 years ago, there was this talk about artificial barriers. The barrier to entry for e-commerce was, do you have hundreds of thousands of dollars to spend on team, infrastructure, architecture, and do you have the time investment? Like, will you put in the work needed to stand up a site? And if you do, there's some arbitrage around paid search and organic SEO that was giving you 10x multiples on your return on investment. And so if you, and I remember it very clearly, watching that era of e-commerce in 2008, 2009, 2010, of seeing 9 and 10x return on investment, and you would spend a dollar and you'd get 10 back. That's what Google Ads used to be. That's what, but as more businesses have come online, that's eroded over time. The cost of entry has also come down over time because that is the law of platform ecosystems. The cloud made that infinitely easier, and cloud-based e-commerce platforms made that easier still. It used to take 6 months to do anything material. Now it takes 6 minutes to launch a Shopify store. You don't even have to go through supply chain and customs to figure out how to build something, and bring it to the United States anymore. You can go on Alibaba buy a lot of things and have it shipped direct from, Shenzhen. And that's the world that we live in has done a lot of arbitrage around removing the barrier to entry to be online. So what happens then is people aren't investing any less in their e-commerce. It's just moved the lump further down the snake, right? It used to be that the barrier to entry was spending on infrastructure and just getting online. Now the barrier to entry is you're online. How are you going to acquire customers? That doesn't come for free. And that's a rising cost that it happens at the same time as creating a customer experience in both B2B and B2C is more expensive now than ever before because it requires an ecosystem of third-party capabilities. To have a best-in-class customer experience, you have to have email. On the B2C side, you have to have retention and lifecycle marketing. You probably have loyalty somewhere in there. You probably have, some sort of rate calculation or carrier calculation. You have some subscription management. All of these things are erosive to margins because they all take a fraction of your, there's no fixed costs anymore. They're all erosive to margins. So they scale linearly with your business, which is not a great way, by the way, to build business. You want to get the unfair scale advantage. And with that comes the repricing of the way cloud software is consumed, is it's no longer based on like terabytes. It's based on GMV. So that also unfairly scales with you. So, long story short, for B2C, it's a challenge. B2B has been undergoing an evolution itself. B2B has more B2C style marketing than ever. There's account-based marketing. There's platforms that run all that lifecycle marketing as well. There's service desk and other tools that, give a total view of the customer to sales reps and sales experiences. There's employee experiences that you have to invest in. There's just so much complexity around integrations that make all of that also very expensive. And guess what? A middleware software also is being priced based on GMV that's running through the platform these days. So the long story short, I've said that so many times today, I'm very long-winded, but it's never been more expensive to be in e-commerce, even though the market's never been bigger. It used to be that we said we're removing the middleman in e-commerce, and that's why e-commerce was the great value prop, was that we don't need a physical brick and mortar store. We don't need so many employees to run it. We don't even need an air conditioned space. We could put product in a warehouse and ship it direct to your door. It's the cheapest thing possible. It removes all of the middlemen between a brand and the customer. It's no longer the case. In fact, now there's more middlemen than there's ever been.
It's true. So, but I also say usually to the customers that are coming to us, like with business cases, and we're rather working with B2B customers, especially on marketplace business cases. And when we describe the market, and it all sounds very complex. What I tend to say is that tomorrow it's going to be even more complex. There's like more competition. It's the salary, the average level of salary will be increased because there's more demand for digital experts. So it seems to be super complicated today. It's even more complicated tomorrow, though there's no, and as there is actually no choice anymore to stay away from e-commerce, though that, which was different like 20 years ago, you could say, okay, I don't want to afford an online shop. So I go with my brick and mortar business or with my mail order business or whatever. So it's a very different entry situation. Also, most companies, especially the ones that are starting in e-commerce right now, they don't have the infrastructure, they don't have the org chart, they don't even know what is a job description for a product manager. What is a product manager in e-commerce, actually, right, when you're coming from an event manufacturing company where product manager is something essentially very different. So, I agree. It's, getting the dollar back becomes more complicated, especially in B2C. I don't agree in B2B right now. It actually is a time where you can spend a dollar and get $10 back easily if you do it right. But it's going to be harder tomorrow. If you have the choice to stay away from e-commerce, if you have like a strategy for the next 50 years where your business can survive without a digital infrastructure, fine, do it. But I haven't met a company yet that could answer this question. And which leads me to my final question about like your e-commerce fiction. I'd like to spend a couple of minutes on future commerce. Yeah. You've been in this space now for so long, and you've been also around when this whole transformation thing started about 10 years ago, transform your company or die, blah, blah, blah. Right. Have you seen one success case where a company with an analog DNA, brick and mortar company, mail order company, whatever, succeeded in digital and was able to get market share back from pure play companies?
You're going to have to edit the long pause. I'm going to have to think through that a bit.
I just give you like one example. So we see some companies in Germany, Otto, for example, so the company I work for, or Douglas, right, that were able to transform a little bit. But they only were able to transform part of their brick and mortar revenue in digital revenue. They never came to a growth rate like an Amazon or eBay in the success days of eBay or Azores or Zappos or whatever. And I tend to say in keynote that, you know, it's like a lottery game. There might be a lottery winner on stage telling you, you know, I tried it hundreds of times. I always lost. But, you know, one time I hit the jackpot and I won. And you can do it too. So it's that is my feeling I have when I have to consult companies with a very, very analog background that want to be in a position where they can compete with digital. So that's why I'm so eager to find success cases. So hard, actually.
There are probably examples, and I'm not astute enough to reference one that's just probably very obvious to most people. I think that there is something to be said about being in the game long enough. It's not about it's what they say in investing, right? You said you listen to a lot of finance podcasts, and there's a lot that exist. I listen to enough of them, and one thing you hear a lot is don't try to time the market, right? It's not about timing the market, it's time in the market. The longer that you're in the market, the longer that, you know, strategies like dollar cost averaging work out for you. And
I hope that that is also true for the Robinhood users. Yeah,
exactly. Well, I hope so too. Meme stocks kind of break that, but the idea here is the businesses that are capable of transformations are the ones who have already evolved and transformed over many, many generations already. The ones that we talk about the most, the ones that we take the greatest lessons from, are the ones who have already exhibited that over their very long lifespan to begin with. And that has taken many forms over many generations. The one that probably just comes to mind and is likely an example I'll be criticized for. But I read Shoe Dog recently. Phil Knight, who was the founder of Nike, who wrote this memoir about, you know, his time in leadership and the transformation of the business. You know, it was a bunch of accountants who started this company. And, you know, they've gone through ebbs and flows of the business. And recently, you know, that is not an example of an analog business that has won out in the end. In fact, it's a business that that I think was very slow to transform and to succumb to what the new world was 10 years ago. And you could have probably counted Nike as, you know, down and out, especially as so many of the wholesale businesses that powered their bottom line were eroding their business and their brand. It was a very risky move for them to invest in digital the way that they have. And it happened to align at a perfect time in the culture where there was a digital native consumer who was ready to spend more on luxury apparel goods that just happened to line up at the right point in time. Again, it's time in the market. They just had to survive long enough for them to be relevant again. I don't think that the story is that dissimilar for legacy businesses who have lived through, you know, many, many changes in culture and many changes in the way that customers expect to be able to do business with them. Of course, it's at a different scale and it's a consumer business, but there's something to be said about, you know, the lessons learned over generations. And, you know, what's really interesting to watch, it's not really commerce focused, but it's really interesting to watch how a business like Facebook has adapted over many generations and implementations of what it was. It certainly started as a social network, but overcame the jump to mobile, and then has overcome, you know, is looking to sort of overcome and leap out of the, you know, the perils of social networking to try to become something more, and to still be relevant to a culture that actually has become, quite adversarial to the way that disinformation spreads in, online, and yet, will likely be relevant in the future. There's a lot of lessons to be taken there, and I'm probably not the one to give the 301 on it, but I think it's an interesting insight to say, you know, there's maybe it's not about an analog business. I just don't have the example on the tip of my tongue, but I think it's about doing the things that are needed to have the fundamentals that allow you to succeed to survive in the market long enough for when you find the product market fit for a culture that's ready for you, whatever that might be.
Okay. Is Best Buy a success case for you? And that
it is, but what's interesting about Best Buy is the total reinvention of what that business is like from head to toe. They are effectively a bunch of shop in shops. Like they are what, you know, a smaller version of what the shopping mall is. And they have, you know, beautiful, very small brand experiences and engagements, activations throughout a store these days, which is very different to the model that they were operating 10 years ago. They had to be imperiled to be able to pull off that sort of evolution. And I think that's one of the, you know, that's sort of one of the evolution life cycle of a modern business is that, you can only really make those kinds of big swings when you're in a situation to have to evolve or die. You know, these days it's also skewing much more toward luxury, which I think is also something that gives you a better insight into the way that margins work in a business like that, especially around, services. More services to deliver, makes you more relevant to more customers, but customers are also willing to spend more, on home and kitchen than they are, say, on, you know, a flat screen TV, which has become extremely commoditized. I think there's something to be said. Home automation is another great example of a thing that, is a service that goes along with a commoditized product. I'm curious what you think about Best Buy and why you brought that up as an example.
I brought this up as an example because it grew like revenue-wise, but obviously it lost a lot of market share to Amazon and other consumer electronics retailers. And we have our Best Buy in Europe is MediaMarkt. MediaMarkt has a very tough time now in order to transform. And they're actually the... you see it not on the revenue side first when they're losing against like digital. You see it on the EBITDA side. So they're losing like their earnings first. So, and one of my former bosses, I ought to say, you know, Mr. Graf, giving away stuff for free, that's easy. So making money out of it, that's the hard part.
That is the hard part.
Which is true, which you see a lot of, and you see it right now, is a lot of SPACs in e-commerce, where a lot of companies are going online now. All the trash is going online. It's it's easy to get to like 300-400 million if you are able to spend 300-400 million right now, if you don't need to earn money. So that's the hard part. But would you be willing to like do like a second episode? Because I would like to bring a couple of examples where I would like to hear your view on, and then we could follow up on the future commerce thing, because there's very interesting blog articles I'd like to talk about with you. But actually, to wrap this kind of success cases up, the interesting thing right now compared to 5 years ago is you see now we have a couple of failed online businesses. So it's not online versus offline anymore. So it's like also online versus online. And the from my my perspective is the only common denominator of success is speed of adaption. So the ones that adapted faster to market changes and customer behavior changes, and the ones that are able to do it now, those are the ones that can win, regardless if it's offline or online. Obviously, most of the adaption comes with like technical capabilities, and like e-commerce companies or pure plays by definition have more technical capabilities. But even a Best Buy or a Lowe's or a Home Depot, they can be like the number one marketplace for DIY, which will be a very different marketplace than the Amazon marketplace. Therefore, there are chances. What worries me is that it's so hard to name success cases. But yeah, maybe we can follow this up on episode number two. I would be super.
I would love to do that.
If you're willing to do that,
I will give you one more line of thought around the Best Buy story. If prior to the pandemic. And by the way, this is actually common to both Lowe's and Home Depot, as well as brick and mortar businesses. Massive distribution services businesses that also exist within its own four walls. Like you are not just buying a product. In some cases, you're buying a line of services that come along with the product.
Yes.
I find that to be really interesting. They have all invested prior to the pandemic in more convenient means of getting products to customers. They all invested in home delivery. They all invested in curbside pickup. They all invested in self-checkout. And they all invested in buy online, pickup in store. I think that's something to be said, is that prior to the pandemic, that's something that was it seemed like probably a losing bid at an element of convenience, or sort of you might have said is indexing towards like what consumer actually needs curbside pickup. Post pandemic, it seems like it's a fundamental for a brick and mortar business to be able to do that. In fact, we see a lot of just-in-time workforce delivery apps, rideshare that have all risen to, you know, fulfill that demand. So I think there's something to be said, like you said, is anticipating the future changes of customer expectations and needs in the business. My outlook on Best Buy is completely different today than it was 2 years ago, and it's almost entirely centered around their foresight in the market to build a capability that no one really knew how badly we would need it.
Yeah, let's follow up on this in episode number two. Philip, thank you for your time. It was super entertaining. Maybe we can do this on a regular basis. Thank you.
I would be more than delighted. It would be great. I'd love to do this.
Thanks for listening in. Please don't forget to rate this podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud, or whatever tool you're using for listening podcasts. That's going to help us to find new listeners. Maybe you can also refer us to a friend. But best thing you can do is listen in next time.